Coast Hills, as you've been told. If you don't recognize me, then my name is Glenn. I get to be privileged to be part of the teaching team here. And as Kevin said, we are a Jesus-centered community creating gracious space through acts of generous love. And as a community, we've been walking through the book of Philippians to reimagine what our community could be, as well as what our own lives could be because of the way the script and the way Paul speaks. So if this is your first time with me, I just want to let you know what to expect. We're going to progress by sitting in the text, which means we read the full passage we're going to look at today. Take a small pause to reflect, because what is important is the word of Scripture, that we meditate and think on that. Then we'll walk through the text, where I'm going to take you through some of the more critical parts of how the text moves, what Paul's saying, how it plays, actually in what we're doing today with the whole letter of Philippians. And we'll go into a section where we riff from the text. And riffing is when we get to improv a little bit. It's when we get to ask the question of how does a 2,000-year-old letter to a random group of people in Asia Minor apply to us in Canada in the 21st century? Because that's a big jump. Sometimes we need a little bit of help understanding the gravity of certain writings or events. Some of you might remember the traumatic event that happened in 1992 when the death of Superman violently shook the DC comic book world. It's hard to exaggerate the collective geek impact this had. I can still remember it. Where I was when I heard the news, I was standing by my brother in a grocery store digging through the comics where my mom would leave us so she could shop in peace. We were still a small town, you're allowed to do that. And I must have been in shock because I missed 10 times of my mom saying, "For all that is good, would you please just leave?" And I was just enthralled. Because this moment inspired a year of debating of we didn't know if Superman would come back alive. Don't worry, he did. And it was the first comic line that actually inspired a full novel. Death came neatly packaged in two limited edition comics, wrapped in a sealed white and black plastic cover. At 10 and 11, Josh and I were tortured with competing desires. You see, we collected comic books, and we knew this was going to be the comic book event of our young life. The comic needed to be in mint condition to be a collectible, but mint condition required us not to read the comic. Once outside of that protected seal membrane, it could be susceptible to damage, to getting shoved under something. Using something can break it. It's no longer a collectible. It's now just a child's magazine. Sometimes we treat our faith and theology like a collector. We proudly gather all the vintage comic lines, neatly displaying them with proper lighting and care, allowing our love for them to keep us from ever taking them out of their protective casings, lest they become corrupted. And so far in Philippians, we've had the option to keep the letter safely displayed and unopened. We could agree with concepts of cruciformity. If you don't know what that is, don't worry about it. Critique of power, salvation, and a community working out faith together. The epistle could be safely left in a sealed package, but that's not the purpose of a comic book or an epistle. As Josh and I opened the comic to experience the story, we had witnessed to a childhood memory as we got to feel the impact of one of our favorite heroes suddenly going out of existence. In the same way, Philippians 4:2-9 demands that its value is added to life, not just consenting to a concept, but risking the discomfort of opening the sealed package to experience the story in a lived community. So in this moment, let's read the text, and I'll give you a couple second pause at the end so that you can sit with the words. I have a special appeal which goes jointly to Judea and Syntyche. Please, please come to a common mind in the Lord. And here's a request to you, my loyal comrade. Please help these women. They have struggled hard in the gospel alongside me, as have Clement and my other fellow workers, whose names are in the book of life. Celebrate joyfully in the Lord all the time. I'll say it again, celebrate. Let everybody know how gentle and gracious you are. The Lord is near. Don't worry about anything. Rather, in every area of life, let God know what you want as you pray and make requests. Give thanks as well. God's peace, which is greater than we can ever understand, will guard over your hearts and minds in King Jesus. For the rest, my dear family, these are the things you should think through. Whatever is true, whatever is holy, whatever is upright, whatever is pure, whatever is attractive, whatever has a good reputation, anything virtuous and anything praiseworthy. And these are the things you should do. What you learned, received, heard, and saw in and through me, the God of peace will be with you. The reason why we pause, just in case this is not something you're familiar with, it's been an ancient Christian tradition not to run things together so tightly that they blend into one, that the pausing allows us to intentionally step into something, but also in the ending of the first part, we can have more weight with the text. So now we're going to walk through the text. And you'll notice in verse 2 that there's an emphatic introduction highlighting the drama. Factions have formed in the community around Judea and Syntyche, who are some of the first female leaders within the early church movements. And you have Paul pleading, please, please, you guys need to come together. And it goes even farther as he looked to the other and said, yes, and even you within the community, help this come together. The object of the first plea was to come to the common mind. The object of the second plea was to help them to facilitate the discussion. Because sometimes we need a facilitator because we can be at odds, and the more you're at odds, the more you have definitive lines, and you can separate by degree. No one knows who the loyal comrade is. It sounds like it should be pretty explicit, but actually we don't know. And following the corporate commands coming after it, where it says to rejoice, to not worry, to pray, there is a good indication that it's talking to the whole community, not just one person. And it echoes Philippians 2, verse 2, where Paul says, now fulfill my joy. And he uses the same word, so fulfill my celebration, fulfill my passion by coming to a common mind. So that which was conceptual suddenly becomes concrete when it enters into a relationship. So the point is, restoring relationships is a community project. And then stepping to verse 3, he introduces, who are these women fighting? They are those who have struggled hard in the gospel. And that is echoing again, chapter 1, verse 27, to where he says, you know what I really want for you guys? In one spirit, for you guys to wrestle side by side for the faith of the good news. Saying, this is what I actually hope for you. And then when he's saying, where's this tension? The tension is happening with two of the leaders who he says has been an example of it. So the hopeful idea in 127, where it says, this is where you should be going, again, is made reality when we look at the people around us. He's asking us to unwrap the comic. These women have stood shoulder to shoulder with Paul to advance the mission. They're people of respect, they're people of authority. And the conflict happened, because conflict will happen with dedicated leaders and seasoned Christians, not just immature novices who don't know what they're talking about. Because often when we have conflict, what we want to do is to defame the other person, to say, you obviously don't know. If you only knew what I knew, you'd be fine. But in this one, it's saying, actually, no, these were the seasoned leaders. And within seasoned leaders, who were the ones who set the example that I hoped you followed back in chapter 1, they're causing a faction. And it shifts in tone to verses 4 to 5. And it kind of has this moment of, since you're fighting, or while you're fighting, it says, celebrate. Verse 4 starts, celebrate joyfully in the Lord. But the verb used there, because sometimes you may have heard it in other translations as rejoice, or to celebrate can be a personal idea for us. We're like, what is my disposition? Am I happy? Am I sad? Am I joyful? This is actually linked to a community notion, because in that time, Paul would use it to talk about temple worship. Because before, calendars used to be set to sacrificial systems at your local temples. So when you celebrated, that was actually the whole village going to the temple to throw a party. So he's not using this as you, be cool. He's saying, no, as a people, while you're fighting, still remember how to celebrate, how to throw a party together. Which anticipates the same way he used it in chapter 2, 10 to 11, to where he says, and you know that because of Jesus' descent to the cross and resurrection, that in the end of days of days, that every knee shall bow under heaven, on earth, and below the earth, and every tongue shall confess that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father. The celebration anticipates that as a reality. And he pulls it into his own story again. Because the way he moves is from a present, so I do this, to a future, I will do this. And he said, the present act of the celebration in conflict anticipates your future hope. Because he pulls from 1:18 to where he uses the same construct to say, and in all of this, in whatever ways people are preaching, he said, whether in pretense or in truth, Christ is proclaimed. And in this, I celebrate and I will celebrate. And then he comes to the community in crisis, the community fighting. And he says, right now with you, you are in crisis, you're fighting, you're creating factions. Celebrate together. And then he says, and I will tell you again when you need to hear it again. Celebrate together. And in that celebration, he says, let everybody know how gentle and gracious you are. Because often within family fightings, within conflict, we're not always so gentle and gracious. But the verb he uses here is actually notoriously difficult to translate into a word, because it represents a whole realm of how we are to sit ourselves. And the realm is generally applied to authority and how authority answers to people. It's used often to juxtapose against someone who is an exacting ruler. You will obey the law or you will die. And then epikeis, which is the verb he uses to go gentle and gracious, is to be the lenient, the grace-filled person who creates some gray area so you can stay here. He creates some gray area to make sure all can be present at the table. Some translate it as magnanimous, as forbearing, patient. It's this act of saying that the community space is sacred in such a way that I need all of you here. It's used throughout the Old Testament to only mention God's gracious rule. So as Paul uses it to say, be gracious and gentle, and he says, because the Lord is near, what he's hinting at is your ability to be gracious and gentle is actually the anticipation of Jesus as king in your life. So literally before all people, the community must be saturated with extreme gentleness that makes room for the warring people listed before. Judea and Syntyche could only exist in a gracious community, which always causes me to question. I can tend to be a little bit exacting because I like literal definitions. But if my standard for how I judge my faith and the community that I'm connected to is the exacting rule, then I am not anticipating the coming kingdom of Christ. Because we are to measure by grace and gentleness, even amidst conflict. Which brings us to the central notion that builds up through the passage. The Lord is here. Because the Lord is here, we cannot afford differences to become factions. We cannot allow temporary pain turn into permanent abandonment. Because we must work out salvation, which looks a lot like chasing Judea and Syntyche. Because in chasing peace, we find God. In chasing restoration with each other, we experience the God with us. And Paul actually builds it up at the end of every command. He says, celebrate, God is near. And then you're going to have two more commands right after this. He says, God's peace will guard you. Then you get two more commands. He says, God's peace is with us. Because he's giving you this notion to find peace, to restore people, is actually to experience the God with us, which brings a peace that is not by conquest, not by power, not by coercion, but by the ability for us to let go of our rightness, of our position of power, of our ability to tell someone else what to do, and say, I can create a space where you can sit with me. And that's where we come into 6:7. And it kind of goes from the let's celebrate, and moves back in. So while you're fighting, pray for the community. He said, don't worry about anything, but in all things, prayer. Make your requests to God so obvious they're cleanly stated. When the sentence is delimited to the don't worry, we can have the tendency to add guilt to our anxiety. When you're in the middle of a fight with somebody and you say, oh, the only thing I will focus on is what I should not do when I talk to my wife, my brother, my coworker, you can obsess over it. It takes too much time in your mind. You don't actually have a good place to go. And Paul says, do not worry, even in the midst of a community-dividing conflict, but pray painfully honest and open with your needs to God. Don't be anxious is also plural. So it points back to the plea to bring the people together while everyone is fighting and taking sides. Even though in that time, the most natural thing to do would be a little obsessive angst. Because I don't know if you've ever had a friend group split apart, and you got to sit through that moment to where you get pulled aside by everybody's like, you really don't know what Kevin did. And you create factions. And then Kevin gets to go around and says, yeah, but you don't know Glenn. You've been around him. He can say things out of turn. Like, he's a bit crass. He's an American. I mean, it's all those weird things. And like, that's right. I knew I didn't like him. And you have this unusable divide. Be anxious in nothing. Points back to the community reality that we trust God to bring the community together. Worry about nothing moves us into an act of prayer, honest, blatant, profoundly painful prayer, sometimes corporately, because as much as you will distance God sometimes, say, I must use polite language, I encourage you to read the Psalms. There are a few times in the Psalms that the people who wrote the Bible said, God, you failed me. I did everything right. You're a jerk. Where are you? And it's the minority portion of the psalm, so if that becomes your only prayer, you might want to talk to somebody. But it's allowed. And in embracing prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, he actually uses a phrase there to say that says, yeah, make it explicit, make it honest, not, God, I hope you do something good. It's like, God, he's a jerk. I don't know what to do, but hey, can we bring this around? Because the point is restoration. It promises then the peace of God will guard you via King Jesus. And this is beauty. If you've been with us, you've heard a few times that Philippi was a Roman colony with a lot of retired generals. It also was a place that a Roman garrison was stationed. So when it uses the term guard you, that is actually a Roman military term, which have immediate response to them. They said, guard you, I get it. There's an army next door. We know what it is to be guarded by power. But in this way, it says the peace of God, which is a non-coercive power, will guard you as you enter this place of tension, not worrying about if we can solve the debate, but only worrying about if we can unite the people in prayer. And as you move through this, the angst-filled moment and practicing praying, it says then Jesus brings peace. It's a peace you only experience while you move, though. If you're waiting for the peace to come before you move, that's actually not the way Paul's structure goes. Then he moves into, for the rest, my dear family. Think through and imitate well. Now, for us, we use family fairly generically. When we say family, it doesn't actually show tint of obligations towards each other. Within the first century, the notion of family actually obligated you towards somebody. Because the greatest thing you could do to ruin your reputation was to not take care of your family. At this point within Rome, having a child didn't mean family. Because until the husband of the household came and said, I will claim that child, you could throw it out and let it die in the wilderness. Because it was a matter of claiming an obligation. So when he says family, he's actually putting some weight on the community. You are no longer strange entities apart from each other, your family. So it says, for the rest, my dear family, the new community, families fight, but they find ways to move forward together. I said, this is how you do it. Where it says to think through things, think through these ways to become the kingdom. We can often link those to an idea of contemplative meditation as a philosophical exercise. If I keep it in my mind, it's okay. But the phrase used for it is not a phrase of contemplation. It's a phrase of action. It's think through or plan for how you're going to buy a house. You actually have to say, how am I going to save? What market am I looking at? Where am I going? Because you're anticipating the action. That's the language Paul's using. Think through community in this way. Whatever is good, whatever is true, whatever is beautiful. And the brilliant part about this is not a Christian list of ethics. This was actually pulled from the surrounding Greek area. And so the Christian mind itself, or this Christian mind trains itself to discover virtue wherever it can be found, not exclusively from us. You don't have to be part of my party, my tribe, my set. The Christian mind thinks through ways to find your virtue, your beauty, and what that needs. That needs me to trust that you are as passionate and loving for the community as I am. That I must trust your intent and your purpose so that when we think together how to bring this about, we come from a mutuality of trust that says we may be different, but we're going this way. And he said, just in case you're not sure, this is what you practice, what you've seen me do, which is a tremendous challenge to imitate, but also that means you become imitatable. Most people like to be an armchair quarterback, calling plays from the cheap seats where we don't have any skin in the game. It won't hurt us if it goes wrong. Paul in this demands that we become involved and imitatable. You've seen me work, you've heard me teach, and now you need to do as I've done. Which can always be run the other way. When we read it as Christians now, seeing it, and we're saying we're growing, we're maturing, we're becoming who we're supposed to be, it should cause us to reflect and say, am I imitatable? What would happen to the community if they practiced the way I lived and the way I responded to conflict, the way I dealt with disagreement, and the way I sit together? Would we become unified or would we split? And in saying imitate me, it again points to the first part of the passage, to where what has Paul done in this letter? He pointed to unity and working out salvation as a part of the community, not a part from the community. This new line gives greater weight to the leaders who need to get together in the opening clause. And in doing this, he ends again with, God will guard you. And now it says, as you learn by doing and bring the community together, the peace of God will be with you. So it's part of the way that we have God with us is the ability to restore. So we're going to step into the rifting section. If you have your notes on the back, this is actually the part where the sentences will correspond. Fill in the blanks if you like. So point one, conflict and struggle brings opportunity for depth in community if you're courageous and vulnerable when facing it. Because when you have courage but no vulnerability, you become abusive, totalitarian, and exacting. When you have vulnerability but no courage, you open yourself up to self-harm and saying this needs to be resolved, but you don't have the ability to name what you need. And so you wind up taking all the wounds again and it becomes a never-ending cycle. For myself, what would it look like if we did both? Is when I first moved up here, I was moving up to plant a church. Now there's a gentleman in my mind named Pastor Larry Gillis. He was a compassionate giant bear grandpa figure. He's about 6'4", about this wide, and his hands wrapped around yours twice. And you tried to get away from the hug, but his arms were long enough you couldn't. And he just loved everybody. He would often challenge me and say, when did Jesus become real for you? And at the time, I was very courageous, but I was very poor at vulnerability. I saw everything as contest. I didn't realize it because in my memory, we had a good relationship. In my memory, he was warm, he was kind, he was compassionate. When I wrote him to say, you inspired some of the way I process who God is. Would you consider sponsoring me in church planning? He wrote back like, Glenn, I'm sorry, but I thought we didn't like each other. And I was like, what? You've been a warm memory my whole life. Because I was courageous without vulnerability. So courage and vulnerability let the people we wrestle with know that we still love and value them. Paul showed this as he humbled himself to plead rather than pulling on authority to demand that both parties and the whole community come together. Yet he was courageous enough to explicitly name the needs to bring the community together. And he stayed present, as he said, I tell you to celebrate, and I will tell you that he stayed present with their development. This is right for the community here, but it's also right at home. When we come towards each other with the ability to be courageous enough to name and vulnerability enough to say, it's not about me winning, it's about us understanding, we can actually create healthier relationships. Point two, progress means trusting God and throwing a party. What are we trusting God for? That the expanding family is actually his goal, not a mistake. Because creating family is difficult. And I actually think I have a privileged position in this because I come from a divorced family. Now, most people don't have to live through what it looks like to have two different groups of people with different traditions, different backgrounds, try to create one family together, which is exactly what's happening here. I did. There was this moment where I always call her mom because Laura's been around my life so long I can't put a qualifier to it, where my grandfather came in, but he denied us being able to call him grandpa because he told my mom, those aren't my grandkids, they're your stepkids. And then she acted like Paul. Courageous and vulnerable, she stepped and said, if you can't claim them who's my family, I can't claim you. It's a package deal. And he took a moment, but he came to it. Her consistent, gracious gentleness and prayer clicked our family's ability to process how far family goes, a step forward. But this was the beginning, not the end. Because family became real as my grandpa Haney showed up to celebrate my brother and I, to teach me how to golf, even to the point that when I started out driving him, he gifted me one of his favorite drivers because he just said, you're my grandkid, you should have this, and you swing it better than me anyways. I didn't, but he was being kind because he wanted a reason to celebrate. That's what the progress is. So following the corporate imperatives throughout the passage, we see the way we progress forward to throw a good party is we celebrate together, we practice gentleness and grace, and then we move through anxiety by engaging in painfully honest prayer. And this prayer is needed to remind us God is intimately intertwined with the uniting of this family that we didn't see coming. The third point is to look for new life guided by old hands. And that takes us to, in life, we can be drawn towards the negative. We can be drawn towards a prohibition, to slippery slope arguments, to saying, how far is too far before I can say I reject you? In life, we can draw a tighter boundary to make sure we have a pure and more pure us. But what Paul said, focus a little differently. In verse 8, where he says, think through these things, focus on what brings life. And you can pull that from multiple sources. And then the next one where he says, imitate me, become someone whose relationships inspire new life. Because his entire argument in this is he challenged coming from relationship. And these are the things you should do. What you learned, received, heard, and saw in me. Not an abstraction over here, not a doctrine long ago. What you experienced with me, is it loving? Is it generous? Does it create space for more people? Then this is what we do. Because the people we gather around creates the meanings in our life. Just think about it. If you've lived multiple places, I've had a time in my life where every 2 years I lived in a new place. When someone said, how did you like that place? The one thing I never said was, it had amazing roads. It was so awesome. It had a tree. Because what makes places important are the people that are part of your life. What makes church important in the expanding community are those you allow to be present in such a way to affect you. This takes faith off the shelf and into reality. And I promise you it'll be messy. But as we're coming to a close, we're going to be transitioning into the moment of communion, which throughout time has been used as a declaration of this is the new family. Churches have used it to say this is how we bring reconciliation to each other. So I challenge you in being courageous and vulnerable enough to face conflict for the purpose of reconciliation. We progress towards Jesus' dream for the community, learning to celebrate in worry and in restoration. Being open to new ways to embody and advance the kingdom of God while accepting the guidance of those like Paul who've gone before us. So now let's celebrate the truth of Jesus with us in this tension as Kevin leads us into communion.